Flight 278, now boarding at gate M for Belgium.
Premier prix, Grand Prix international Reine Elisabeth, prix de la Reine Fabiola. Marcus Groh.
When one opens the new companion to music by the Oxford Press, one can read Eugène Ysaÿe, one of the most outstanding musicians of his times.
That's chocolate!
That's chocolate.
That's the most fantastic thing I've ever seen.
Praline flavored, plain fresh cream, coffee flavored, chocolate mousse. This is orange with a little bit of Grand Marnier. Pistachio, plain but with a dark cover, raspberry, pineapple with rum.
From the stage of the Queen Elizabeth International Music Competition to the library of the great violinist Eugène Ysaÿe, from the grand organ of the Cathedral of Antwerp to a monastery created to bring together different cultures, and even to a chocolate factory that produces Belgium's most luscious export, I'm Robert Aubrey Davis. Join me in the next hour as we go on holiday, a cultural tour of Belgium. Belgium, the crossroads and battleground of old Europe, and now the capital of the United Europe, where the town crier still resounds through the streets of the medieval town of Ghent, where violinist Eugène Ysaÿe, here playing the finale from the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto, championed the composers of his day, inspiring Debussy, Saint-Saëns, and César Franck. In fact, Ysaÿe's legacy lives on in violinist Isaac Stern.
For me, in the pantheon of great violinists in the history of the instrument, naturally there will be Paganini and Wieniawski, Heifetz, and Ysaÿe.
Ysaÿe's library and studio are now preserved at the Royal Conservatory in Liège. Chantal Bastin is a music critic and guide at the museum.
When one opens the new companion to music by the Oxford Press, one can read Eugène Ysaÿe, one of the most outstanding musicians of his time. So he's known all over the world, in the States, in Belgium, in France. He was one of the leaders of the Belgium School for the Violin. He remains somebody very important here.
These two tiny rooms are filled from top to bottom with manuscripts, music scores, and books.
We have all the books he likes. We see he was someone very learned. All the scores on this hand and encyclopedias. Here we have a cast of Ysaÿe's hand, his left hand, showing a good position of the fingers on the neck of the violin.
Ysaÿe's desk is cluttered with his collection of pipes, his tobacco pouch, his composition notebook, and photographs.
There are a lot of portraits of Ysaÿe, and well, it would be difficult to say a word of all of these statues or pictures. We have two interesting pictures, Ysaÿe when he was a young man, there right, and here left, and the Queen Elizabeth. She was a close friend of Ysaÿe. Ysaÿe was maître de chapelle at the Belgian court, you know probably that. And he was working, he used to work with those two portraits on his desk, not photographs of his four children, but, well, the king and the queen. His Guarnerius is now belongs to Isaac Stern, so he gave it to Münch. Then came to a violin maker, an American violin maker, Hermann, and then Stern bought it from Hermann.
I own the Guarneri that is called the Isaac Guarneri, which has inside of it a little piece of paper glued to the back saying, "Ce Guarneri fut le fidèle compagnon de ma carrière." This Guarneri is the faithful companion of my career. And I hope that I'll put a piece of paper next to it and say mine too.
Isaac Stern, celebrating his 60th anniversary as a performer, has been a lifelong admirer of Isai.
Isai was a towering figure musically and violinistically. I remember Casals telling me once that the group of them, Pugno, Casals, Isai, Chrysler, Thibault, and Corto, all got together for various kinds of chamber music every summer in France. And I said, oh my goodness, to have heard Chrysler in those days playing chamber music. And Casals looked at him and says, yes. He says, but you know, when Isai picked up the violin or the viola, he played them both, we all became children. That was the measure of Isai and his contemporaries. And there was that too in his playing, this lust for living, this joy of hearing the sound of one note going to another. A caressing of the phrases and of the love of sound that was very hearable. They were made largely on wax discs at the time he was earlier on, and every note is perfectly in tune in there.
Isai only recorded 12 works in his own lifetime, all in December of 1912, including this piece, his own mazurka, Opus 11, number 3. Thank you. Eugenie Saib, December of 1912, performing his own work, the Mazurka, Opus 11, Number 3. As you can hear, Isai was himself a composer and created a form for violin and orchestra called the poem, which was then taken up by his contemporaries, including his devoted friend Ernest Chausson, whose Opus 25 poem, written for Isai, is the most beautiful example of the form.
The Chausson poem and the César Franck sonata, they come out very felicitously because I don't play them. I just whisper to the fiddle, "Here, honey, play." And it does it by itself. I just stand there and listen.
The poem, Opus 25, by Ernest Chausson. The poem, Opus 25, by Ernest Chausson, written for Eugène Isai and performed by Isaac Stern on Isai's own Guarneri violin. Isai created his own concert society, premiering works by his friends Chausson, César Franck, Vincent Dandy, Debussy, and Fauré. And in addition to building the audience for this circle of composers in Europe, Isai also brought the Franco-Belgian cultural message to the United States. Again, Chantal Bastin.
He was not only an interpreter, he was a composer, a conductor. He was appointed director of the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra because he had problems playing the violin, because he suffered from neuritis in his left hand, so it was more and more difficult for him to play. So gradually he went only to directing most of the time.
Although he toured all over Europe and America as soloist, conductor, and founder of the enormously popular Isai String Quartet, his heart was always in Belgium.
And we see on a stand a reliquary containing the heart, the real heart of Eugène Isai.
This is his actual heart, is in effect buried here in this beautiful studio of his.
It's a small box in tin made by a Liège sculptor, Louis Dupont. And we can read a small phrase. Ne jamais rien faire qui n'ait pour but et moyen l'émotion, la poésie, le cœur. Never do anything that hasn't as aims and means emotion, poetry, heart.
Madame, mesdames et messieurs, ik kondig u nu de namen aan van de zes laureaten zoals ze door de jury gerangschikt werden.
When in the mid-1920s, the Belgian Queen Elizabeth suggested a worldwide music competition for young violinists, her devoted friend Eugène Isai immediately embraced the idea. Although he died before the first contest in 1937, the first two winners, violinist David Oistrakh, and after a piano competition was added in 1938, pianist Emil Gilels, set an unparalleled standard.
The drama is tonight, because nobody knows. You know, even the jury doesn't know.
Karel van Creveld is executive vice president of the Queen Elizabeth competition.
Being the first is not a guarantee for a career. I mean, you got something, now it's up to you to see what you do with it. And you have many people who are sixth or seventh or fifth who are making a much bigger career than those who were first. I mean, it all depends what you do with it. You know, you open the door to fame. Now, some of them, they don't take the wrong bus, and it never comes back. The bus is there for you. Do you get in? If you miss the bus, and it's a one-way ticket.
Most professional musicians agree that the Queen Elizabeth competition is the most important in the world, and everybody recognizes it's the most grueling. Much documentation is required just to participate in a blind elimination round. The contestants are then further winnowed in 20 to 30 minute first round performances that leave 24 survivors. The jury selects one work from the performer's known repertoire and a work by a living Belgian composer. After this round, there are 12 survivors. Now they're called laureates. At this point, they're locked into quiet studios at the Queen Elizabeth Chapel for a week to learn a new concerto, one never before heard, played, or even seen on paper, that has been written especially for the competition. They're allowed 2 rehearsals with the orchestra and no contact with the outside world during this week. Each of the 6 final nights of the competition features 2 laureates in formal performance before a sold-out house, a pan-European television and radio audience, and perhaps the most difficult of all, a jury of the most eminent musicians in the world. I talked to 1995 laureate Yulia Gorelman from Baltimore, Maryland, before the final 2 laureates performed.
So, Yulia, we were walking around talking to shopkeepers earlier about the competition and, you know, people in the streets, and you had some votes. People want you to win, which is, I don't know, I'm just glad to see that happening. What is it like being at this stage? You know, we're waiting for the results coming in just a few hours.
It's actually very exciting, and the surprising thing is I'm not nervous to wait for the results because I've done everything I could, and I'm really happy that people like my playing and my personality.
When you had to sit down and learn this work by the English composer John Weeks, what was that like for you anyway?
It was very stressful. We had 8 days to learn the piece, and we had all the stress behind us already, and we were stayed all in a chapelle and isolated, completely isolated from the world. To learn the piece, was the hardest thing was not to panic, because when you see it, it's kind of terrifying because there's so many things to learn in the shortest possible period of time. Plus, I had to play Prokofiev.
Everybody in Brussels, shopkeepers and cab drivers alike, follows the young performers, attending the many elimination rounds and rooting for their favorites.
If you go for a walk in the street, you can hear people talking about the competition, and people from every different level of the society. Yes. And we have we can watch on the TV every night, so everybody can follow the competition.
Very important role in our Belgian music life. Very important. It's a contest created by one of our queens, so it's a royal contest.
On the final night of the competition around the Palais des Beaux-Arts, it looks to American eyes like a major sports spectacle. People spilling out of stairwells, arguing about their favorite finalist, some wandering around the square with portable radios.
In the morning, you can check the opinion of some musical criticists over
everyone is concerned by the competition. Poor people or rich people, it doesn't matter.
Midnight, and the last performer has left the stage. The Queen retires to a special supper as the judges make the difficult choices in ranking the finalists. When finished, they alert the competition president, who kneels before the Queen to announce that a decision has been reached. 1 a.m., the public rushes back to the hall for the long-awaited announcement of the winner.
Premier prix, Grand Prix International Reine Elisabeth, Prix de la Reine Fabiola. Marcus Grove.
Backstage, a horde of reporters and journalists from around the world swarmed around Germany's Marcus Grohe, the 1995 winner of the Queen Elizabeth competition. He won with his performances of the new work for the competition, Thomas Weeks' Piano Concerto, and a stunning performance of the Liszt Second Piano Concerto.
Marcus, you've won this with a spectacular performance of the Liszt Second Piano Concerto. In America, we say, what are you going to do now? And you say, I'm going to go to Disney World. But what are you really going to do now?
It's like in a dream, so I'm overwhelmed by emotions and nice people everywhere. I must say that I like staying here in Brussels from the first day. I had a very nice host family here and a very good practicing possibilities, and I think that's why I played so well to win first prize here.
What is that week like where you're locked away and you can't see anybody and you're all by yourself, and what does that feel like?
It was quite strange, so I was glad that it was only 1 week. And we always made jokes about, because the name of the of the composer was weeks. So I said, it was one of the most difficult weeks I've ever had in my life.
Marcus Groh in his winning performance with the Liszt Second Piano Concerto. Thank you. Marcus Grove, the 1995 winner of the Queen Elizabeth Music Competition, playing the finale of the Liszt Second Piano Concerto. You're listening to On Holiday, a cultural tour of Belgium on PRI, Public Radio International. The proud and ancient cultural heritage of Belgium is found most spectacularly in its medieval architecture, like the cathedral in Antwerp, one of the largest Gothic structures in the world. Stanislas de Riemacher is the organist of the Antwerp Cathedral.
I came here when I was very young with my brother once. He was a printer. And I came to an Antwerp Cathedral, and I was here, I think. And I said, be organist in a church like that, that's really the most exciting thing you can wish, you know, as an organist.
One of the great stories about this cathedral is when Leopold Mozart brought his son Wolfgang and his little daughter on a tour, the great tour of Europe, and he was so inspired to see this place. I guess young Mozart actually played the organ, did he not?
Yeah, he played the organ here, but think on that, Mozart was in this cathedral, in this building, he had seen these windows, these seven naves, you know, it's a 120-meter-length cathedral, it's unbelievable, yeah. It's exciting thinking on that these genius people were here.
I had this whole cathedral to myself. As I looked around at this vast Gothic expanse with a magnificent painting of the Descent of the Cross by Antwerp native Peter Paul Rubens, I wondered what piece of music it could possibly play that could make this experience even richer. Bach's Toccata and Fugue in D minor, played by Antwerp Cathedral organist Stanislas de Riemacher. The Flemish opera has made a notable success of finding young audiences for an art form often considered old-fashioned and out of date.
If you make dull, old-fashioned productions, you will have older people in the audience.
Marc Clemer is director of the Flemish Opera.
If you try to do more modern music theater, that means not having only fat singers singing their arias, but having real visual important productions, then you will also attract a younger audience.
Marc Lemer has clearly spoken to a new generation of opera goers and has extended opera subscriptions beyond the boundaries of his home country.
There are even subscribers who are from abroad. So we have something like 200 subscribers from the north of France, the neighborhood of Lille, Roubaix, Tourcoing. And we have even 1,000 subscribers from Holland. So they take even subscriptions, comes from 100, 150 kilometers. We have also a youth club called Cherubino for young people till 26 years old. They have now 2,000 members or something. They make trips and have conferences around the operas. Outside this club for younger people, we have quite young audiences. But that's because we make not trendy productions, but productions in which we attract importance to the theatrical side. Try to show people in which you can believe and not having Madame Caballé, Mr. Pavarotti, pretending they are Mimi and Rodolfo and your young bohemians in Paris who haven't eaten since a week.
Clemer has yet another selling point, a theater that matches the 18th century heyday of opera itself.
Operas in a theater of the same period for which this opera was meant. I think that is, for American people, a thrilling experience. And also, I think there are some interesting houses in America, like Houston or Chicago, but I think there are a lot of houses in America also who want to bring the big stars, who often arrive 3 days before the first night and don't bring that kind of opera. I mean, so not only about singing, but like opera originally was meant as a sort of total art. So not only the voice, not only the orchestra, also the set, the costume, the acting. Opera as a total art.
With voices raised, the Flemish opera is reinvigorating an old art form. While in the village of Chevetonia, voices are raised for a very different reason. A group of monks has chosen song to heal an ancient rift. The Benedictines created the monastery at Chevetonia in 1925, the first ever designed to bring together the long-divided Eastern and Western Christian churches. The monks sing Byzantine chant, again reminding us of Belgium as a place of cultural crossroads.
We have here in Chevetonia, Belgium is of course a plaque tournant, turning table. We're very, very close to France, to Germany, to Holland, Luxembourg, of course, even to Britain.
Father Thad Barnes came to Chevetonia from America as a young man in the 1960s.
There are people who come more and more from farther afield now. We get people from Eastern Europe more and more. The reverse side of that coin is that we also do a lot of traveling, we in Chevetonia, which is not typical of Benedictines, in order to get to know the cultural, musical, artistic traditions. One will have to go sur place to those countries and see how people sing theirs, to see how the art is alive there. But for us, it's much more than simply a cultural act. It's a question of a forming fellowship.
You have, of course, this, it's almost like walking into a geode when you walk in here, because there are these exquisite icons of all stripe.
The best of our ancient icons were acquired in the 20s when the Soviet Union was getting rid of its less ideologically desirable heritage. Icons are works of art, and as such, they're highly appreciated, more and more appreciated in the West. But they're also the basis of a whole spirituality, a spirituality of incarnation, of God's presence in his creation.
In the Eastern Church, the icon is a living expression of a spiritual reality, and more people find chant as a musical expression of the spirit. Although Thad Barnes believes that in a land where many cultures meet, we can never truly remove ourselves from the outside world.
Naturally, to be a monk is to try to arrange one's life in such a way that you've got enough time to meditate the Word of God, which is music in itself, the Word of God. But to do that closed off for the world without being able to welcome people It wouldn't make any sense.
The monks at Shevatonia have found a surprising resonance in their mission of uniting people of different cultural and spiritual heritages through music.
Here in Shevatonia, we've got a very particular situation. That's that we're using somebody else's liturgy. We as Roman Catholics have taken over, as respectfully as possible, have taken over the Eastern Orthodox liturgical tradition in order to come to know Christianity through it better. I was going to say, in order to know that Eastern tradition better. Yes, that's true, but more important than that is to go through that tradition to find our own Christianity at a deeper level. But when you take someone else's spiritual or even cultural heritage over, that's all fraught with dangers of playing around with something that doesn't belong to you. So we tend to be as conservative as possible in using the spiritual heritage of the Orthodox Church in order to deal with real respect towards them and not to doctor it up according to what would be our own ideas. Our way of singing chant is instantly recognized by our Russian friends as very interesting, but not Russian.
As Benedict said, you know, there's the need to welcome in people who come to your door. What are sort of the levels of people and the kinds of people, and how do you deal with that in the midst of a busy monastery?
Welcoming people is basic to living in community. Hospitality for the Benedictine tradition that we try to follow is absolutely essential.
The Benedictine monks of Shevatonia who've taken up the mission of singing Byzantine chant.
Крест начертава в небесах. крайне убежищах от тоже в обратно фараоновым колесниц, ударив совокупи, вопреки и написан, непобедимоего оружия, тем Христу по Богу нашему яко прославись.
The Benedictine monks of Shevetonia who've taken up the mission of singing Byzantine chant. Music, art, medieval architecture, and for a cultural pilgrim like me, the summit of all aesthetics.
That's chocolate!
That's chocolate.
That's the most fantastic thing I've ever seen.
Oompa, loompa, loompa-dee-doo, I've got a perfect puzzle for you. Oompa, loompa, loompa-dee-dee, if you are wise, you'll listen to me.
What do you get when you guzzle down sweets?
Brussels is to chocolate lovers what Canterbury was to medieval pilgrims. The family-owned Wiedemeyer Chocolate Factory makes over 70 varieties of succulent sweets.
You make your own candies.
Yes.
You make your own ice creams.
Yes.
You make your own cakes.
Yes.
You do all your own baking.
Yes.
Everything is right here. And everybody on the radio right now, I want you to take a deep breath and just smell what it's like here to be in the... Oh.
Other countries lay claims to chocolate works, milkiness in Switzerland, the alkali process called Dutch chocolate, the popular bars that defined Hershey's success in America, but for sheer silky and sensual perfection, nothing is equal to the Belgian mastery of the chocolate craft.
That's the factory where, in fact, my grandfather started the bakery business in 1910.
Miriam Wiedemeyer is the granddaughter of the founder of Wiedemeyer Chocolates.
It's made out of whipped cream, meringue, and chocolate, copeaux de chocolat, pieces of chocolate.
And this is where they shred the chocolate on this machine.
Oh, man. Farther on to the chocolate section of our praline, where we made the our Wiedemeyer Belgian praline.
I'm standing here speechless because there's so many different kinds of chocolates here. And you can actually have an assortment of any kind you want. How many different kinds of chocolates do you think you have in the range?
About 70.
70 different kinds of chocolates.
Praline flavored, plain, fresh cream, coffee flavored, chocolate mousse. This is orange with a little bit of Grand Marnier. Pistachio, plain, but with a dark cover, raspberry, pineapple with rum.
Candy, I call my sugar candy.
I'm currently eating one of the best chocolates. In fact, this is why chocolate is, in Latin, food of the gods.
Got a sweet tooth for my sweetheart Candy.
It's gonna be just dandy
the day I take my candy and make her mine, all mine. It's gonna be just dandy
the day I take my candy. Gee, how the sun will shine on the day.
This program was produced by Maureen Hanley and Molly Murphy. The mixing engineer was Robin Wise, Director of Operations Lynn Terrell. Special thanks to Soren Sondergaard and Sandra Aumann of the European Commission Delegation in Washington, D.C., Andrea Murphy and Giselle Egerman of the Embassy of Belgium, Frederica Reimachers of the Belgian Tourist Board, Karine Sinev and Jan Wietuk of the Tourist Office in Brussels, Dr. Urban Klaas, High Commission of the Tourist Office for Flanders, Vera Vishorin of the Antwerp Tourism Office, Cecile Ferrier of the Queen Elizabeth Competition, Susan Fleming and Jean-Michel de Rove of the European Commission in Brussels, Albert Wastio of RTBF, Belgian Radio and Television, Richard Fried, and in Dublin, Ireland, Pat Dunn and Harry Bradshaw. Production support was generously provided by WETA-FM in Washington, D.C., and Sun Recording Studios in Dublin, Ireland. I'm Robert Aubrey Davis.